Today on Against the Grain, it's well known that Donald Trump's electoral support was disproportionately comprised of white voters. But if you remove white evangelicals from the picture, white voters supported Clinton by a margin of 6 points. Which begs the question, how did evangelicals become such a force in American politics? And how did Christians, and not just evangelicals, end up supporting the interests of the corporate elite? I'm Sasha Lilly. Historian Kevin Cruz will join me to talk about the alliance of big business and Christian churches. We'll also discuss Donald Trump's use of religious nationalism. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The United States is an ostensibly secular nation where church and state are kept separate. So how is it that the currency is stamped in God we trust, and according to the Pledge of Allegiance, the U.S. is also a nation under God? The answer lies in a marriage between big business and Christianity, which has its origins in opposition to the New Deal, and which has evolved through the presidencies of Eisenhower, Nixon, Reagan, and now President Trump. Today, I'm joined by the historian of the right, Kevin Cruz, who teaches at Princeton University. He's the author of One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America, published by Basic Books. His other books include White Flight, Atlanta, and the Making of Modern Conservatism. Kevin, let me start by asking you this. There's an assumption, a common assumption, that Americans are and have been a church-going population. To what extent is that assumption correct?
Well, church-going population is an interesting phrase, and it's one that's kind of hard to measure. If we go by church membership rolls, it's actually not true. If we look back to the 19th century, for much of that, less than a fifth of Americans claim to regularly attend services. It creeps up over the course of the late 19th and early 20th century, but it only becomes a majority really in the post-World War II period and only very briefly there.
Well, then what changed? What drove the shift if this is not the historical trend, if this is not somehow deeply embedded in the DNA of Americans that they are religious and primarily Christian? What shifted in the early to mid-20th century?
Well, what shifts is there's a conscious campaign on the part of prominent figures, both in politics, but also, as I discovered, in religion, obviously, but also as I discovered in the business world, to try to get Americans to go to church. And so you see a concerted campaign from business leaders, from advertisers, from celebrities, urging Americans to take their faith more seriously and to wind it into not only their everyday lives, but to make it an explicit part of their nation's politics, too.
Well, perhaps you could set the stage about what was happening politically at the time. So you obviously had the Great Depression. There was the New Deal that really transformed American society in many ways, was embraced by many and alarmed many others. How did the New Deal shape the emergence of a different kind of active religiosity that was married with conservative politics?
Well, the story begins in an unlikely place. It begins in the boardrooms of major corporations. The New Deal had put big business on its heels, and it did so in two ways. The Great Depression had shattered the confidence Americans had had in businesses, which had been incredibly high in the 1920s. Businessmen were regarded as heroes, if not gods. That gets shattered with the stock market crash in 1929 and the 3 years of steadily increasing economic misery that follow. The New Deal then comes in, and it does two things that from the perspective of business is really alarming. One, they start to regulate business for the first time seriously from Washington, D.C., impinging on their economic freedom. And at the same time, they empower labor unions for the first time in a lot of these major industries. And what that does is suddenly business feels like it's getting it from without and within, and they're feeling constrained. So they launch a massive campaign to push back. And groups like the National Association of Manufacturers, for instance, a major industrial lobby, vastly increased the amount of money that they're spending on public relations. Really, I mean, they hire a public relations director for the first time for this purpose. And they start throwing out millions of dollars of work on a PR campaign that involves everything from a speaker series to ready-made articles and editorials for newspapers, advertisements, films, on and on. And the central message of this campaign early on is basically one built solely on economic arguments, that big business is good for the economy and we need to trust in it once again. The problem is that these arguments on behalf of big business come across like arguments on behalf of big business. They seem incredibly self-serving. So another of these groups was called the American Liberty Lobby. And it was heavily financed by groups like DuPont and General Motors. And the problem was it sounded like it was financed by DuPont and General Motors. Jim Farley, the head of a Democratic Party, said they ought to call the American Liberty League the American Cellophane League because, number one, it's a DuPont product, and number two, you can see right through it. So all of these early campaigns that big business had thrown out, spending a vast amount of money, essentially falls on deaf ears. No one really is persuaded by this. They see right through it. They denounce it as propaganda. So business leaders decide they need to try a new tack. And by the late 30s, they are actively supporting a new set of spokesmen who are making the case on behalf of big business. But they do it in an interesting way. They make arguments that don't stress economics, they stress religion. And they do so because businessmen realize that the most trusted people in America at this time are ministers. They say this quite explicitly. Therefore, we should get ministers to make the case for us. And those ministers make a case based on religious freedom. They make an argument that the New Deal represents the slavery of the state. And as opposed to that, you have a business representing freedom under God.
Obviously, with the religious right, we've seen for a long time a marriage of religion and big business. But on the face of it, Christianity and free enterprise seem like strange bedfellows. Was that the case? Was this marriage of these two seamless for them, or were there tensions that existed in trying to pull these two together?
There are definite tensions, because at the time of the New Deal, many religious leaders rallied around the New Deal and its regulation of business. They argued, as the head of the Federal Council of Churches did, the main umbrella organization of Protestant churches, that the New Deal is essentially embodying Christian principles, such as the importance of food and shelter. Give us our daily bread. They said that's essentially what the New Deal is doing. So business leaders have to find ministers who will take a more creative approach with Scripture, and they do. They find, in particular, one of the people I single out early on and one of the key people here is a Congregationalist minister out of Los Angeles by the name of Reverend James W. Fifield. And Fifield is politically conservative, but theologically liberal. He had no patience for fundamentalists who read the Bible literally. In fact, he said, we've got to sift through the Bible. We've got to discard these warnings about the dangers of wealth, that a rich man will never get into heaven. That's not true, he says. And so he says, we've got to approach the Bible like we eat fish. We take the bones out to enjoy the meat. All parts are not of equal value. So again, he discards hundreds of passages in which Christ makes condemnations of wealth and power, and instead finds a way that reconciles his vision of Christianity with capitalism. And he does so through a political framework. This is where the politics comes into it, because he says, look, Christianity and capitalism are both systems that value the individual above all else. In Christianity, an individual soul rises to heaven or falls to hell based on its own merit. That's a slight theological ugliness, but that's what he argues. In business, if you're good at business, you make a profit. If you're bad at business, you go to the poorhouse. So they're both systems in which the individual rises or falls on their own. The New Deal, he says, violates that, because it's a form of pagan statism that violates, again, that sacred freedom under God, that freedom to rise or fall on your own.
Was it the case that these ministers were conservative to start with, and hence the idea of joining forces with the business class seemed appealing?
Yeah, most of them were. Most of them. So Fifield's a good example. Fifield's church, First Congregational Church in Los Angeles, is the largest congregational church in the country at the time. It's also, I think, probably one of the richest. He is literally ministering to millionaires. In fact, he reveled in that identity. He was he called himself the apostle to millionaires, Saint Paul to the prosperous. He revels in this, and he lives personally the life of the wealthy. He has a giant 3-story mansion on Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles, and so he sympathizes with this very rich and in the Depression era Los Angeles, very conservative congregation he has, and he tries to minister to their needs, and he does so by telling them that their political worldview is one he shares and one that, in fact, Christ shares.
You just mentioned Los Angeles. Was there a geographical component to the backlash against the New Deal? Were these business and religious leaders concentrated in particular parts of the country?
Los Angeles crops up time and time again, but it really is all over. I've got another a major figure who comes out of Seattle. Chicago figures in a lot of this. Norman Vincent Peale in New York City. Billy Graham is a mixture of North Carolina and Wheaton, Illinois. So it really is a movement that takes place all over. And it's one that really sees this not as something that is going to have a certain regional base that we might expect when we think about later manifestations of the religious right, really rooted in the South and the Midwest. This is something that is actually born all over the country.
You just mentioned evangelist Billy Graham, who had a very long history going across the terms of many, many presidents. What was his role in this fusion of Christianity and free enterprise, and how influential was he in shaping a kind of new sort of politics?
He's hugely important. And we've largely thought of Billy Graham and sort of his later manifestations. But we have to remember that when he came on the scene in 1949 as a 30-year-old evangelist, he was very much a part of this movement we're talking about, this movement that I call Christian libertarianism in the book. His early rallies, his early crusades, as he called them, were filled with condemnations of organized labor and praise for big business. He tells a rally in Greensboro, North Carolina in 1952 that the Garden of Eden was a paradise in which there were no labor leaders, no union dues, no snakes, and no disease. He tells a crowd in Boston that the kind of religious revival that he's calling for in America is one in which a worker won't strike against his boss, in which a worker will put in a good, honest 8-hour workday and then go home. Business leaders, meanwhile, he constantly likens to the most esteemed religious figures you can imagine. He constantly is calling for them to be recognized as people whose worldly success is a sign of their favor from God.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm joined by historian Kevin Cruz. We're talking about the history in the 20th century of the fusion of the Christian right and the corporate right. So under Eisenhower, who, though a Republican, did not seek to dismantle the New Deal, he created a sort of significant shift, which is that prior to him, against the New Deal, there had been a fusion of free enterprise and Christianity against the state. But under Eisenhower, that shifted so that actually the state became the embodiment of religious and Christian values. How did that shift take place?
Well, it takes place largely through a pivot Eisenhower makes himself. So he gets elected with the help of these Christian libertarian groups. So Fifield's group, which is called Spiritual Mobilization, Abraham Verde, who is the force behind the National Prayer Breakfast as it comes into being under Eisenhower, and Billy Graham especially, is a constant source of advice, feeding him scripture lines and themes to talk about on the campaign trail. And Eisenhower is a true believer when it comes to this Christian libertarianism. The problem is once he gets into office, he quickly realizes, he quickly decides that he will make peace with the New Deal. In fact, he writes a famous letter to his brother, Milton, where he says, if any party does away with labor legislation and Social Security and things like that. You'll never hear from that party again in our lifetime. It's just not going to happen. And in fact, he greatly expands the New Deal. He strengthens Social Security. He oversees the biggest public works project of the post-war era, the federal highway system. He does a lot to actually deepen the New Deal state, and his former libertarian allies are furious. What Eisenhower does, though, is he doesn't abandon the religious language that they'd used. He flips its purpose around. They had always used that religious language of freedom under God as a way to challenge the state, to tear down the state. Eisenhower takes it and spins it around and instead uses it to prop up the state. And so an early theme of his presidency, which emerges at that very first national prayer breakfast that he presides over in February 1953, the theme is government under God. So previously it had been freedom under God as opposed to a godless government. And instead he makes it a government under God and makes the state itself sacred.
What did the big business that had been supporting this opposition to the New Deal, how did they react to Eisenhower? Or were they in more of a minority, since quite a lot of the business class seemed to have reconciled itself by that point with an economy that is regulated and the role of labor unions as they were in the 50s?
Some of them are furious, but most of them, as you note, had made peace with the New Deal state by that point. And most of them recognized that for all of his expansions of the New Deal, Eisenhower did actually roll back some federal regulations of business. And the labor laws had changed before he was even in power. So that was no longer really a pressing concern. And they generally were happy with the large-scale prosperity of the era. And so they were making enough profit that they didn't, they weren't worried about that kind of libertarian drive.
So tell us about how there was a shift under Eisenhower. You mentioned a moment ago that Eisenhower initiated prayer breakfasts for presidents, which already seems quite strange when you reflect on separation of church and state. And then, of course, he supported legislation to add the phrase under God to the Pledge of Allegiance, embracing in God we trust as the nation's official motto. How did he initiate these things, and what was his agenda in doing so?
Well, Eisenhower's agenda here is one in which, and I think it's quite sincere, is that he believes that religious faith can be a unifying force in America. And that it helps explain its institutions. So he's got a famous line that he gives, and he gives it to one of these Christian libertarian groups when he's president-elect in December 1952. And he famously says, "Our form of government makes no sense unless it's founded on a deeply felt religious faith, and I don't care what it is." Now, religious critics mock him for this. William Lee Miller, who's a liberal theologian at Yale, says, apparently President Eisenhower is a very fervent believer in a very vague religion. And they used it to kind of mock the substance of Eisenhower's faith. But I think Eisenhower actually was onto something there, because he knew that the only way in which religion could work in American politics is if it was expansive and almost intentionally vaguely drawn. And so that's why you see all the things that happen in his presidency, from the National Prayer Breakfast to the addition of Under God to the Pledge of Allegiance, In God We Trust on paper currency and stamps, and then becomes the national motto, all these various things that happen, and there are many more, they're all drawn at that broad level. They're drawn in what legal scholars would later call ceremonial deism. And they use that term to mean a ceremonial from their eyes, that it wasn't important, it was merely ornamental, and therefore the law couldn't handle it. But deism was key, in that the deity was always vaguely drawn. You never had formal invocations. Well, sometimes you did, but almost never you had formal invocations of Jesus Christ. It was rather a God that could be embraced by what was increasingly referred to at the time as the three great faiths of democracy: Protestantism, Catholicism, and Judaism. But there's also space made under that. Occasionally, they explicitly make space for Muslims, for Buddhists, for Hindus. And so there's a sense of the religious diversity here. It's only really non-believers who are kind of seen on the outside here. Eisenhower's minister says, an atheistic American is a contradiction in terms. You simply can't be one. But so he does this this broad, inclusive faith, and he sees it as a way to unite Americans. And in this, he's both a pioneer and he isn't. There had been a move underway really from the 1920s to think about the connections between Protestants, Catholics, and Jews in America. And it really takes off during World War II, when the government is trying to find ways to unite Americans and downplay the ways that divide them. What divides them are their old ethnic loyalties to their nations of origin. So, you know, if you're a German American and you have a French American neighbor, World War II is a divisive topic for you. If you, however, come together on your shared Christian faith, you've got something that unites you. And so they started in World War II to advance that. Eisenhower, who had seen this at work during the war, picks this up and makes it a major theme of his presidency. In fact, I'd say it basically defines his first 100 days, if we think about the important ways in which presidents set their presidencies off, from his inauguration through this time of year around February of 1953. He is involved nonstop in promotional campaigns to get Americans to embrace faith.
Well, despite the breadth, the sort of big tent of the religion, especially for Christians, but even maybe beyond Christianity, was there any resistance, any substantial resistance, to injecting religion into the state in such a way, given that, as you are arguing, this is not actually the long history of the United States?
Surprisingly, no. At the start, the only conflict over some of these things comes from who's going to get credit. So the debate over adding under God to the Pledge of Allegiance is instructive. It happens with incredible speed. The only thing that slows it down is basically sponsors in Congress fighting over whose bill is going to be the one they all rally around. And it's Democrats and Republicans, it's liberals and conservatives, it's Catholics and Protestants and Jews. They're all involved in this. They all rally behind this. The agencies that you think might and the organizations you think might object to this simply don't. The ACLU only learns about the change to the national motto after it's passed the House. It's already almost done before they even hear about it. And they have some internal discussion of, should we challenge this? No, we've actually got bigger issues to deal with. You know, this is the era when they're focused on McCarthyism, and that's the real peril in their eyes. This doesn't seem like a huge civil liberties issue. Meanwhile, Americans United for Separation of Church and State was at this time known by its original name, which was Protestants and Other Americans United for Separation of Church and State. And as that name implies, they weren't worried about a general embrace of religion. They were worried about Catholics getting taxpayer money for parochial schools. So this kind of broad embrace of the sacred is fine. It's when a particular sect gets an advantage, that's the problem. And again, that doubles back to Eisenhower's comment. As long as you've kept this at a broad, vague level of God in which no individual faith feels like it's being singled out for benefit or being penalized, then all these forces will come together around it. Once you get into a much more divisive issues, and those come later, then trouble starts to brew.
Why did religiosity increase in the 1950s amongst Americans? Was it because it was state-sanctioned, or were there other dynamics going on in the society as well? And did that increased religiosity apply primarily to white Americans, Americans across the board?
It's really Americans across the board. And there are... If you ask an historian why something happened, we'll say yes, it's all these reasons, right? And so there are a lot of different factors we can point to here. The state's embrace of it is one thing, and the contrast they make with the Soviet Union is key here. This campaign had been underway for decades before, but it really catches fire in the 50s as the government is really promoting a concept of Americanism that is defined largely in opposition to what the Soviet Union is. The Soviet Union is godless and atheistic. Sometimes they use those words at the same time, godless, atheistic, communist. And therefore, a good American has to be godly. So there's an encouraging of taking religion. But it comes from the government, but it also comes from business leaders. It comes from – there's a massive advertising campaign promoted by business leaders called Religion in American Life, which instructs Americans that it's their duty as parents, their duty as good citizens, to be involved in their local church or synagogue. And at the same time, you see a surge in pop culture here. The 50s are a moment in which many of the best-selling books are religious themed. Many of the blockbuster movies are religious themes. So The Ten Commandments is one of the biggest movies of all time. Still, it's got one of the, I think, the top 10 box offices. It is a religious epic, obviously, but it's one with a political motive in mind. Cecil B. DeMille, the producer-director of that film, was a member of James Fifield's church. He had been an active supporter of this cause of Christian libertarianism for decades. And he says that the theme of the Ten Commandments, and he says it explicitly in interviews and even in a short film clip they show before the film is shown in theaters, he says this story is basically one of, are men going to be slave to the state, or are they going to be free souls under God? So he really just captures this earlier Christian libertarian theme. But again, it's a promotional campaign that takes place behind this movie. It gets this movie out, and it's widely popular. And part of the promotional campaign is the setting up of Ten Commandment monuments all across the country. And so there are about 4,000 of these concrete monuments stone monuments are set up across the country. They later become the subject of fights over separation of church and state, as some of these are literally a part of city halls and courthouses. But at the time, they're incredibly popular. At the time, they're largely uncontroversial because they seem to embody and embrace this larger rush to religiosity. And so over the course of the 50s, you've got all these different sources, the government, business, advertisers, pop culture, all leading Americans, encouraging them to go back to church, to go back to their synagogue. And so you see an incredible surge in religious attendance. Now, the problem is that attendance number can be misleading because if we look below the surface, sometimes the religion can seem thin. So polls showed that vast majorities believed in the divinity of Christ, 80% or more. Then follow-up questions asked those same people who fervently believe in the divinity of Christ to name any one of the Gospels. And something like 30% could only name one. So it shows a religiosity that is incredibly broad, but I think also at the same time quite thin.
You mentioned popular culture a moment ago. Tell us about Walt Disney and Disneyland.
Well, Walt Disney and Disneyland, Disney is, again, another of these men who fit into this libertarian mold, who think of themselves as outspoken Christians who have something to say on this topic. And with Disneyland, which was, I think we forget what a novel and an amazing development it was at the time. He opens up Disneyland and has a theme that we now know as the Hall of Presidents, which you see at Disney World. But originally it was going to be called One Nation Under God. And he was going to use these animatronic displays, again, high tech, incredibly impressive at the time, to spread this message that America was essentially a Christian nation, that it always had been.
I'm Sasha Lilly. The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And today I'm speaking with Kevin Cruz. He's professor of history at Princeton University and the author of One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America. That's published by Basic Books, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. So if Eisenhower tried to unite Americans with his marriage of the state and religion, Richard Nixon and his allies sought to drive a wedge between them. What did this fusion of Christianity and conservative politics look like in Nixon's hands, and what was going on in the 1960s that shaped these debates?
Well, Nixon, again, we have to remember, was Eisenhower's vice president. And so he had literally had a front row seat to these events that had happened in the Eisenhower administration, the creation of One Nation Under God, the National Prayer Breakfast. He is right there and witnessing what Eisenhower can do. So he knows the power of these political religious rituals, right? When he comes into office, he tries to recreate them, but he does them in a very Nixonian way. He does them not to bring Americans together. He rather uses this language of religious nationalism as a way to advance his own policies in a kind of America love it or leave it approach. So he does this in a number of ways. His inauguration is one that uses religion to really play up the themes of the silent majority. And then he does so at events like the National Prayer Breakfast. But then he goes even further than Eisenhower had done, and he starts having actual church services in the East Room of the White House. And behind the scenes, his aides say this was crassly political. We did this solely to score political points with the press, with certain members of our base, to woo congressmen on certain issues. So the guest lists are done in a way in which they bring together a congressman they want to lobby with people who will help sway their opinion on things. And again, these are topics far removed from what you might think of as religious issues. The anti-ballistic missile treaty is one. The sales tax change is another one. And so they're constantly bringing these people together to hear sermons from conservative ministers, always conservative ministers. Billy Graham was a regular guest, but they get a lot more there to preach a message that is promotes the silent majority, but also they use this moment to build a kind of silent majority community in these church services that seems entirely wholesome, that brings together millionaire donors, congressmen they want to sway, and conservative icons in politics and pop culture, and they bring them all together in the White House to promote this. It at the time is condemned as kind of a clumsy PR thing, but it's incredibly effective. It becomes a very popular activity among his constituents. Another way he does this is he holds rallies with Billy Graham, and Billy Graham had always been associated with the presidency. From Eisenhower on, he had a kind of disastrous visit with Harry Truman. But from Eisenhower on, he's a mainstay in the White House, both Republicans and Democrats. And he does so by maintaining a slightly less political tone than he'd originally had. With Nixon, though, he goes all in. He had known Nixon, again, since the 50s, since the Eisenhower administration, considered him a close friend, and really throws his prestige behind the president. And so when the Nixon administration comes under fire during the war on Vietnam— particularly after the invasion of Cambodia and then the slaying of four students at Kent State in May 1970, he leans hard on Billy Graham. And he gets Graham to do two things. One, to hold a massive rally with him in the football stadium, Neyland Stadium, at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, with 100,000-something people in attendance. And then he gets Graham to work with Bob Hope to hold this massive rally on the 4th of July in 1970 called Honor America Day. And both are sold to the public as technically non-political events, that one is just a celebration of public faith. The other one is a 4th of July celebration of America. But both events take on a very partisan tone and are very clearly seen as ways to promote not public faith or patriotism, but to promote President Richard Nixon and to defend him from his critics. And that if you do believe this is one nation under God, if you do believe our motto is in God we trust, then you should put your faith not just in God, but in the head of this government, and that's Richard Nixon.
In the 1970s, there was a profit crunch. And I wonder how the relationship between the corporate right, corporate elites or the business elite, and the religious right was reconfigured at that time. To what degree did it need to be reconfigured, and to what degree did that take place?
When we think about the forces that lead together to the Reagan Revolution of the 1980s, it brings together different strands of conservatism, and two of the key ones are the religious right and the business forces, which seek more of a libertarian approach to government. And so they come back together on the grounds of this kind of Christian libertarianism, and they find an alliance that is much like the one they had during the New Deal, where whatever their differences on key issues, they both agree they want to get the government out of their lives. So for social conservatives, it's getting the government out of their private Christian schools. It's rolling back abortion rights. It's rolling back feminism. It's rolling back gay rights. It's changes like that. For business conservatives, it's rolling back the regulatory state, which had grown under Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon. And so there's a real concerted move here to come together and to come behind the rallying cry that Ronald Reagan gives in the 1980 campaign of getting government off our backs. And they both agree on that. And so they very easily form a coalition that is has a kind of an anti-government animus at its heart.
Who were the foot soldiers of the Reagan Revolution? Speaking of the people, the evangelicals and other Christians who ended up supporting this turn, participating in it. What was the basis of it in terms of race, in terms of class? Who were these people?
Well, in terms of race, it's overwhelmingly white. There's a significant contingent of Asian Americans, small numbers of African Americans, Latinos, but it's an overwhelmingly white constituency. In terms of his class, it actually cuts across class lines. You've got clearly kind of the traditional establishment Republicans, business leaders who fall behind the Republican Party constantly. You've got middle class suburbanites who had really been there since the days of Eisenhower. And then you've got more kind of the white working class, what we think of as classically as the Reagan Democrats, who rally around a Reagan as somebody who will stand up for them and their needs, as somebody who will push back against economic decline, push back against an increasing view that America was weak on the world stage, and plays to their need for a stark patriotic appeal. So it's one that really goes across class lines, but is still, in terms of race, overwhelmingly white.
What about denominations? We tend to associate evangelical Christians with the religious right. Who else denominationally was part of that alliance?
Well, evangelical Christians are a huge part. You've got obviously large numbers of fundamentalists, but increasingly you've got conservative Catholics being brought into this coalition, and Mormons as well. And these groups come together in uneasy alliances in the 1970s. And they're deeply distrustful at first. Evangelicals think Catholics are essentially pagans. They think the Mormons are a cult. They have different views on the issues. When Roe v. Wade happens, Catholics are deeply concerned with the issue of abortion. Most Protestants, including evangelicals, don't think it's a big issue. Early polls of the 1970s of the Southern Baptist Convention, for instance, show 70-80% of pastors and lay members there are fine with legalized abortion. So they're originally on different pages and they're hostile to each other. But over the course of the 70s, they come to see that they have a common enemy. And that's what really unites them. They come to see that the state is increasingly involved in their lives as they see it, and for negative reasons. And so they rally around this idea that they should all be together. And they do so, again, it harkens back to how Eisenhower understood religion. They do so by downplaying the theological and doctrinal differences between their faiths. The moral majority, which is the most significant group here, Jerry Falwell's organization, they get their name from a moment in a meeting in which one of the organizers says, well, out there must be a moral majority who believes in the principles of the Decalogue, who believes in the Ten Commandments. And if you boil it down to that basic foundation of faith, you get beyond what divides Baptists from Methodists, from Catholics, from Assembly of God people. You really get down to that fundamental core that they can all basically agree on. If you actually push them on this, they realize they have different texts for this, depending on their different Bibles. But they agree that in theory, there's this vague, basic, fundamental faith that unites them. And once they make that their point of contact, they come together.
My guest is Kevin Cruz. He's a historian, author of One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America. My name is Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So I'd like to spend the rest of the time that we have talking about the religious right, the intersection of corporate and religious interests as they manifest today in the era of Donald Trump. How do you understand Trump's take on religion? Obviously, he's not exactly a role model of Christian piety or upstanding behavior, and yet he has quite a solid basis of support from at least evangelical whites. How do you understand his support from these people?
Well, clearly it's a support that's based on a kind of a transactional relationship. He had very light support early on in the campaign. He had a great number of evangelical leaders who were outspoken and hostile to him early on. He had some who were in his corner early, from Jerry Falwell Jr., for instance. But it wasn't until the summer of 2016 that he really got evangelicals and the leaders of the religious right behind him. And he did so by explicitly promising that he would name a Supreme Court justice who would overturn Roe v. Wade. He sent out a list of actual names of judges, which a candidate I don't believe has ever done before, to assure them that if they voted for him, that he would give them what they wanted most, which was a judge to fill the Scalia vacancy, who would be stridently anti-Roe.
Well, let's talk about Trump's religious nationalism. He is not someone who seems deeply rooted himself in any kind of religiosity, but as you say, he has commanded the support from various religious people. Certainly, his politics are steeped very deeply in nationalism. If you look at Nixon and then you look at Trump, how would you say that their take on religious nationalism is similar or differs?
I think Trump's a lot like Nixon here in that he's very clearly using religious nationalism for his own political ends. And also, I think, like Nixon, in fact, more than Nixon, is using it cynically. Nixon had been raised as a Quaker and occasionally came back to that faith. He noted when he held these events that he was, you know, quote, "I just gave him some of the God stuff." He's very cynical about it when people talk about the comments he made. Trump is, I think, very much in that vein. But I think it's even more pronounced. Trump's own background, he says he was a Presbyterian who attended Reverend Norman Vincent Peale's Marble Collegiate Church. But there's actually no record of him being a regular member of any Presbyterian church or Marble Collegiate. Still, he speaks about this this faith animating him. He may bungle the references a lot. He's famously called out for 2 Corinthians rather than 2 Corinthians and got a lot of criticism for that. But he's still, regardless of his inability to kind of articulate that faith, he understands the role of rituals of faith. And so for him, the faith has never really seemed to be a personal thing, but he understands its place in our polity. And what he does with this embrace of religious nationalism is he uses it as a way to, I think, essentially further his real goal, which is nationalism. And so the religious angle becomes a way to sell this. And he does so through associations with people like Franklin Graham. Billy Graham had embraced religious nationalism, but again, had done so in a very inclusive way. Billy Graham had always spoken about all the faiths coming together, had made room, for Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, had really had an expansive understanding of this. With Franklin Graham, it's less of a embrace of a broad religious tradition, and it's more exclusively a Christian nationalism. And that's a real narrowing of this viewpoint, and one that clearly animates the ways in which Trump thinks about things like the immigration ban. And we should note that that's actually an issue which has caused the support from evangelicals to splinter. The National Association of Evangelicals and other leaders in the evangelical movement have been outspoken in condemning the immigration ban because they've actually been strongly engaged with protecting refugees. So they see this as, I think, many Christians would. They see this as the duty of a good Christian to take care of the stranger, to take care of the refugee. There are countless places in the New Testament they can look for authority on that, and it's not easy for them to shrug it off.
Well, religiosity in the United States is on the decline amongst younger generations, and clearly, just looking at the present moment, Trump can be a very chaotic figure. You've written that the base for the religious right is becoming more divided, and I wonder what you think this means for the future of the right and of conservatism and religion, both in this moment and then looking further ahead.
Well, I think there's a real, for all the dominance that the Republicans have now at every level of government, all three branches, they control the presidency, they control Congress, they control the Supreme Court. I think there's a real fragility there in some ways, in that that masks both internal divisions they have, but also presents them with a unified a government that they haven't had since 1928, when they looked invincible, and then their fortunes quickly changed with the Great Depression. So we're seeing, in terms of their political coalition, it's at a moment of apparent strength right now. But again, those large numbers breed large groups of internal divisions, which they'll be fighting out for control of that, which can be problematic to the overall coalition. On the point of religion, there's a generational problem here, is that while many of the old religious right leaders came to rally around Trump, James Robeson, James Dobson, Tony Perkins, Jerry Falwell Jr., people like that, Franklin Graham, well, they've rallied around Trump. They've done so at the real risk, and I think the real cost, of alienating younger evangelicals who increasingly don't want to have this kind of role in politics. So I think the next generation of even conservative evangelicals are going to be much less likely to be involved in politics, especially if the Trump administration comes to be seen as anything less than a sterling success. If they don't get everything they're hoping for at this moment, if those promises that their leaders have made don't come true, I think you're going to see a real rebellion on the ranks of the new generation of evangelicals.
And that would be a huge blow to the Republican Party, because just looking at the figures for white voters in the past presidential election, that evangelicals voted disproportionately for Trump. And if you factored out white evangelicals, that the remaining non-evangelical whites voted by a majority for Clinton. But the thing that was particularly interesting in those numbers was that white evangelicals turn out at much higher numbers than the rest of the population. So in a sense, they're punching above their weight. And yet, if their numbers are declining, and as you mentioned, if there's this generational divide, then that seems like something that for the Republican Party could be very significant, perhaps even in the more near future, rather than, you know, many years down the road.
I think that's right. I mean, again, if you look at the key bases of support right now within the Republican Party, it's a population that skews much older than the general voting public. And so if they don't have this new generation of evangelicals to come in as not just regular voters, but kind of foot soldiers for mobilizing other voters, there's going to be a huge cost when those older voters are gone and these younger voters haven't come in to take the place.
Do you think that there is any sense of urgency, therefore, amongst conservative religious leaders to try and get everything that they can get at this point, given that demographically things don't look so good? And then connected to that, obviously there are many corporate interests that have no connection to the religious right, but for those that do you think there's some unease there in terms of what the future holds?
Well, you know, I'm an historian, so I'm trained in hindsight. It's difficult
sure.
for me to predict the future, but I'd say that we are at a moment that I think shows the real ways in which contingency matters, and I think both of those trends could be potentially incredibly problematic for the party. We've seen corporate America and the religious right are no longer in lockstep. You saw this with the ways in which different corporations came out against the so-called religious liberty laws in states like Arkansas and Indiana that would have authorized discrimination against LGBT individuals. NASCAR came out against that. Walmart came out against that. Things that would have seemed unimaginable a decade or so ago, they're clearly realizing their consumer base, that their customers don't want these things necessarily, and therefore they're not going to abide by them. So we've seen a rift between corporate America, even conservative corporate America, even Walmart, again, headed by a family that that carries its religion very close to itself. So you've seen a split here. And so I think there is a danger of this this coalition fractioning. It's very fragile.
Let me end by asking you about religion that isn't tethered to the Republican Party or to the right. You've noted that Democrats also use the language of religion and Christianity at that, looking at Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton. Why do you think that is the case? Is this just the long history of, at least going back to mid-century, to Eisenhower, this sort of fusion of the American state with religion? Do you think that religious nationalism has a life of its own separate from the Republican Party? Or are there other reasons that in a country where church and state are supposed to be separate, that people in both parties evoke religion in politics?
I'll look back. I'm going to look forward. So if we look back even beyond the Eisenhower era, we have to remember that the New Deal that these Christian libertarians railed against was itself sold in religious terms. Franklin D. Roosevelt loved to make religious analogies. His first inaugural address was so filled with religious references that the National Bible Reporter printed out the entire text with arrows and loops going to the various bits of scripture that the president had invoked. And he could a speech on something dry like water utilities. He would condemn private water powers, and his speech began, "My sermon today comes from the Old Testament, and my text is, thou shalt not steal." In his second inaugural, he referred to himself basically as Moses leading the American people to a promised land. So liberals used to use this religious language. And so I think when you see someone like Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton, who did it even, I think even more than Obama did, really speak about the role of faith in their lives, that goes back to an older tradition. The problem for the left here isn't that liberalism and religious faith are incompatible. Far from it. If you look back to the old social gospel of the New Deal era, you see that religion can be a real tool here. The problem is that the Democratic Party's base is becoming increasingly fractured on this issue of religion. And so you have, as you note, large numbers of people who categorize themselves as secular, as agnostic, as atheist. That's quickly becoming about a fifth of the electorate, and it's largely on the Democratic side. So for a Democratic leader to try to navigate between these deeply religious liberals and deeply irreligious liberals, or on the far left, that becomes a delicate line to walk. And we saw Obama try to do this when he made what was unusual at the time, a reference to believers and non-believers. So to go against that old Eisenhower refrain in which an atheistic American was a contradiction in term, Obama made it clear you could be an atheistic American, and that changed nothing about your patriotism. But it means that the line that Democratic leaders have to walk is a very delicate one, because they've got to reach out to both the religious and the irreligious, and it's not a problem you see with Republicans and the right.
I've been speaking in this hour with Kevin Cruz. He's professor of history at Princeton University. His books include White Flight, Atlanta, and the Making of Modern Conservatism, and he's the author of One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America. That's published by Basic Books, and we have a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Kevin, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against. Thank you.